Blog Talk Radio.
Forbidden archaeology, forgotten history, divination, magic, cryptozoology, UFOs, nature, science, and spirit. All this and more right here on the Main Street Universe Radio Network.
Listening to Main Street Universe, the show and network reminding you that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined.
Hello everyone, and welcome again to another episode of Green Magic, Green Medicine with your hostess Susan Weed. I am Daniel Michael, the founder and co-creator of the Main Street Universe Radio Network, alongside with my friend Mr. Kevin Baird. I'll briefly describe some of the other shows on the network, starting with this one, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Green Magic, Green Medicine with your host Susan Weed. And attached to this show page, this episode, this web page here from which you listen to the show, is a direct link to Susan Weed's bookstore, which also takes you to all different other places, the Wise Woman Center and everything else. So check it out. 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Tuesdays and Wednesdays, 7 p.m., the show that started it all, myself and associate producer Janice R. White, and that is Main Street Universe. And again, every week, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, we talk about many different things, and soon will be Karen Tate visiting us July 9th. And Karen is an author of a new book about all different places on the earth where the divine feminine is found. So check it out, July 9th. She's with the Fellowship of Isis. Karen Tate, and we'll be discussing her new book that is coming out. So that'll be July 9th. Thursdays at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, we have Queen Mother Imaku. She does original Kemetic prayers as well as teaches Kemetic yoga. She's a priestess in that tradition. So check it out, 10 p.m. Thursdays. Fridays, we have Activating Compassion in the Midnight Hour with Jesse Ann Nicholas George. She's the author of four books, Activating Compassion and its companion book, as well as You, Me, Like Dreams and its companion workbook, all about relationships, so check that out. And I consider that to be a much more mature version of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, but she might not say that herself. But saying that the different energy levels we have in all of us that are masculine and feminine. Fridays at midnight, Sundays at 7, now at 5:30, forgive me, p.m. Eastern Time, we have Darren Bouquer with his show Spiritual Insight. Darren is a reader of tarot and palmistry at Marie Laveau's House of Voodoo in the magical city of New Orleans, and he himself has a book coming out called Tale of the Serpent, and it's all about the different tarot spreads that he's created from his years of experience as a reader and at that fairly well-known place that, from which he does it at Marie Laveau's. Then Monday at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, we have Randy Goldberg with the show Science of Light. Last week he was discussing Introduction to Meditation. He discusses all things metaphysical, esoteric. He's a Vedic astrologer as well as a Western astrologer. So check it out, Randy Goldberg, Science of Light. And so I think that rounds the table here of the seven shows on the Main Street Universe Radio Network. I see Susan is in the queue, and I'm turning her microphone on now. Welcome, Susan Weed.
Green blessings. I'm so glad to be here with you again.
And I am glad to be here as well.
How's your week been?
I was just about to ask the same exact thing. It's been very interesting and productive, you know, as some folks may know, I've been took off of my day job because of my knee injury, which is healing beautifully now. And we've been getting a lot done musically, and our sound engineer has actually been sort of crashing over here at the house. So we've been getting a lot of the album done, which is going to be called Songs of the New Old Ways. And we're getting close. We're about a month and a half or so away, we think. We're bringing in the guest musicians and some other things. So it's coming along.
Yoo-hoo! Congratulations. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
Oh, that is fantastic. Oh, what's been going on here? Well, somebody sent me some sacred blue corn.
Ah.
She got it from a Native American medicine man 20 years ago, and she's been carrying it in her medicine bundle. And we're not talking about a little bit of corn here. We're talking about, like, probably 3 pounds of blue corn. And I've been choosing the people around and about to give it to because my sense of these plants is, well, it's nice to keep a couple of kernels of any sacred corn that comes my way. I try to get it out and planted. I feel that the plants want to be growing and planted. They don't just want to be saved as seed. Not that I'm against seed banks or saving seeds. But this is certainly enough seed that I think its vitality is increased as an annual crop if we take it out and plant it. And speaking of which, one of the sisters to corn is beans. And I may have talked about how last year I was going out to our CSA, pick your own garden, and picking green beans. And, you know, doing my best. Not to pick more than my share. Well, it turned out, because I often go to the CSA far later than other people will go, I'll go out there in November. And a lot of those green beans weren't picked. I may have, you know, picked only my share, but there were many people's shares that didn't get picked. And so those had all dried, and they were all dried beans, and I just collected all those dried beans. I got like, oh, I don't know, maybe, you know, like 5 pounds of dried beans there in the field. And my granddaughter and her friends planted some of those beans this spring, and those beans are now starting to grow and to get tendrils. And the girls are just so excited by their beans, and they're even more excited because they remember helping us shell those beans and where those beans came from. And so I like this. I like playing with food and playing with seeds in that spiraling way so that the past moves into the present, and it does it through my body so that I know that I am the carrier of the wisdom of the past and that I can reach out a hand to the new generations and show them how to step into that spiral, how to step into that movement, and to contrast that perhaps to the more modern sense of wealth is something that we pile up and we don't use it, rather than wealth as being something that we share and something that's abundant and something that we grow and something that we can find. So those are some of the kind of interesting garden things that we've been doing. I've also been doing for my mentored students a step-by-step photo illustrated nettle infusion from start to finish.
Oh.
Yeah, and that's literally from going out and deciding which nettle to harvest, how to harvest it, how to hang it, how to decide when it's dry, how to take it down, how to store it, how to make infusion from it.
Because I have some and I need to make infusion with as well, so I need to look.
There you
look.
Go. And, of course, also how to make infusion from what you buy commercially.
Mm.
Yeah, so those have been the little things that have been keeping me charmed and busy. Now, I know that I've mentioned before that Fridays for my granddaughter and always a friend or perhaps two of hers come to the farm, Grandma's farm, and spend Fridays at Grandma's. And this past Friday, we really went wandering far out into the woods, and we found a fairly big birch tree that had been brought down by a storm this winter. And you know, birch is very interesting. I don't know if you've been around birch, but birch is one of the few trees where the inner part of the birch rots away before the bark does. And this actually features notably in some Native American stories. And if you have walked in the woods, you'll see just like the birch tree, the bark, like sitting there hollow and empty. And this tree was not that far along because it had just fallen this winter. It was still sound enough for us to sit on. And the Fomes fomentarius was growing from this birch tree. And when I first saw it, I was very, very excited. I thought, whoa, that is a really important medicinal mushroom. How perfect that we have come upon it right here in our own woods. And if you look at it, it looks kind of like a black horse's hoof. And there were sizes from little bitty ones, not much bigger than my nose, to really big ones, far bigger than my two hands put together, growing out of this downed birch tree. It's actually quite possible that the birch came down because of the Fomes fomentarius growing on it, because it's not a mushroom that's especially symbiotic or kind to the birch tree, although that view has been called into question. The idea was that the mushroom caused the tree to rot, and there are more modern mycologists who are saying, caught before the horse here. The birch tree was starting to rot, and so the Fomes was invited to grow there to move it along through the cycle. So it was interesting to me that I had found this, because within a couple of days, a friend of mine called me up and said, listen, I was talking to this person, and he has this tincture of chaga, and he's trying to sell me this tincture of chaga. What do you think? Should I get it? And I said, well, what is he telling you about this? Now, chaga is a black mushroom that grows on birches that looks like a horse's hoof. So it is not Fomes fomentarius, but to the uneducated eye, they look alike, and how fortunate they are used exactly alike. The vast majority of the shelf fungus, in other words, fungus that don't rise up into kind of your supermarket mushroom with a stalk and a cap, but the ones that tend more to be growing off of trees and like fans and have pores on the underside, those polyporous mushrooms turn out to be some of the best cancer fighters and some of the safest mushrooms for the amateur to mess around with, shall we say. The really poisonous mushrooms are the ones that look like mushrooms, like in Alice in Wonderland. But the more medicinal ones are the ones that have these, they're literally called shelf fungus or polypores. They don't have the gills, but they have pores on the underneath surface of them. So I said to him, so what is he saying that chaga is used for? And he said, well, he says for older men like myself, he's about to turn 80, that it really helps to, you know, improve your, you know, libido. And I said, really? He says, yes, and it's a real like tonic to the energy system. I said, okay. And already my antenna are going up because I know that that there isn't any mushroom that has been linked to being a true aphrodisiac or influencing hormone levels at all. And then when we get the kind of generalized, you know, it improves or it tones this or that or the other thing, then again, my suspicion meter starts to go into the red zone. And so it got me curious. And I found quite a wonderful site, www.medicinalmushroom.net. And I know quite a bit of about mushrooms, and I could say that this site definitely is not pushing mushrooms for sale. It's not pushing or hobbing horsing any particular view toward mushrooms, but it is quite an excellent compilation of information about the specific mushrooms. And I posted a picture of the Fomes fomentarius, and interesting number of people wrote in, kind of evenly divided between what is it and what do I do with it, to, aha, Fomes. What a great find. And Fomes, like chaga, has been used as an anti-cancer mushroom. What I've been hearing, and especially from being in the presence of people who work with mushrooms, is that we are learning so much about mushrooms and how mushrooms interface and interact with and prevent and deal with cancer, that it's really best, if you actually have a cancer diagnosis, to work with someone who has either access to the scientific information that's now available or who knows that information to help you really fine-tune which mushroom you want. So it used to be that we would say, oh, this mushroom, like this reishi mushroom, right, is a wonderful anti-cancer mushroom. But we're getting a little more sophisticated now. And so instead of just saying it's anti-cancer, we are acknowledging and recognizing that cancer comes in a huge number of different forms and different stages of those forms and different tastes. Perhaps colors, we might call it, but just to indicate that cancer is not one entity, but it's a great, great number of different entities. And then when we further add that to the individual person and their individual metabolism, we get literally hundreds of thousands of different diseases, really different diseases, that can be honestly called by one name, cancer, and yet they can't honestly be treated by one thing. The information on the Fomes and the chaga, however, would lead one to believe that these are panaceas when it comes to working with people who have cancer. I remember the first time I tried working with these mushrooms, and I don't know if you can hear this. I'm hitting the mushroom on the table.
Oh, wow. Pretty hard.
That's a hard mushroom, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Sounds like a drum set here. All right. There's no, you know, real give to this mushroom. It feels like part of the tree when you pull it off. You really feel like you're, like, taking off a big, big hunk of the wood of the tree, and especially from the birch, you will get pieces of birch bark inside that. And so I remember the first time that I tried to make anything out of this kind of mushroom, and it was a real flop. It was a total failure. Somebody had given me a piece of chaga, and I had read that, well, what you do with was boil it, and I put it in a pan, and I boiled it, and I kept an eye on the water, and I boiled it, and I boiled it, and I boiled it. I boiled it for 24 hours, and at the end of 24 hours, I had a pot of boiled water and a piece of chaga. And they were not speaking to each other. And I should not lead you in any way to believe that the chaga had gotten the slightest bit softer. It was exactly what you would expect from boiling a piece of wood. You're going to wind up with a piece of wood and water, right? There's not going to be too much going on there, and especially if it's a dead piece of wood where there's no sap or resin. So what I know that what people have started doing is sawing up these hard mushrooms and actually using the sawdust, so running it through a bandsaw over and over again to cut it into ever thinner pieces and keeping the sawdust and tincturing. Of course, it's not really sawdust, but it is the dust from sawing your chaga or your Fomes mushroom. But what I told my friend was, I think it's an insult to the plants to use chaga in this way. Chaga is not the most common mushroom in the forest. And it is a mushroom that counters cancer. And interestingly enough, it is also a mushroom that counters tuberculosis, TB, and especially antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis. So when I'm working with a plant, or a mushroom in this case, that isn't terrifically common, that might even be considered rare, although perhaps not endangered, I like to treat it with a great deal of care and respect. Now, I did indeed harvest some of this Fomes and bring it home, as you can hear by my knocking it, because I know that it will retain its medicinal potency, being as it is like a piece of wood, for many decades. But that if I were to leave it into the forest, it would become food for the next form of life, probably insects or something else. And although I don't need it right now, who knows when I might need it, or friends or people that I know might be in need of this very mushroom. So my sense was that I preserved it. I'm not sure about the harvesting of chaga because I haven't done that. It might be the same, that when it's harvested, it is something that would just cycle through and not be there again, not be there in its intact form in 4 or 5 years. Or it might be that by over-harvesting the chaga, not enough spores are getting out, because this is a non-flowering plant. All mushrooms are non-flowering plants. That means that they don't have flowers, instead they sporulate. Isn't that a wonderful word? And they create these, what's called the fruiting body, which is their spores. And the spores do a most amazing dance. I mean, spores are like your original, oh, don't tie me down to any gender definition, because there's male spores and there's female spores, and there's male spores that turn into female spores and female spores that turn into male spores. And there's spores that aren't exactly sure what they're going to be until they get into the situation, and then they choose. And so it's just a really wonderful spectrum that is going on with the sporulating plants, which especially include mushrooms, but also, of course, mosses and lichens and ferns, the biggest categories of non-flowering plants that we cohabit with. Now, herbalists across the world use non-flowering plants as well as flowering plants. We tend to be more generalists. We don't just say, oh, yes, we're only going to use the plants that we can grow in a garden, or we're only going to use wild plants. Our herbalists tend to say, how can we see what this plant offers us? How can we connect with this plant so that we benefit from what the plant has, and so the plant can benefit from how we are interrelating with it as well? I think someone once counted and said that there are currently over 10,000 different flowering and non-flowering plants used officially as medicine worldwide, and that if they were to include home remedies and things that aren't considered official medicines, that that number might be far, far greater. So it got me thinking about the mushrooms. Actually, in a way, it got me being nostalgic about the mushrooms, because mushrooms was really my first entry into it. When I was a little girl growing up in Dallas, Texas, I lived on a block, a subdivision, you know, one of those wonderful subdivisions that were done after the war. I was born in 1946, so the leading edge of the baby boomers. And there was a small cliff at the end of my block, and it was just enough to stop the bulldozers. So at the end of my suburban block was this little cliff, and I could clamber down it, and then there was, you know, the mysterious magical woods there for me, with a little stream called the 7 Mile Stream, and a big chalk cliff with a cave in it where I could go and brood and read and be in a place that was mine when the world seemed too much for me. And beyond the 7 Mile Stream and beyond the cave and beyond this magical, mystical woods was a train track. And on the other side of the train track was the Dallas Zoo. And so what this means is that when I fell asleep at night, I fell asleep listening to the sounds of lions and tigers and elephants. Yeah. What an imprint to have on that young psyche. Not just the imprint of going into that woods, into that cliff, into that river, so that nature was always there for me in ways that adults and people weren't, but also to have that nature in a way confused in me, and so that it wasn't the wildlife sounds of the area where I was living that I was hearing, but the wildlife sounds of Africa that I was hearing. And I always thereafter, when I could choose, chose to dwell close to or even right within the woods. When I was going to UCLA, I managed to live in a place right across from a big park that was between the street I was living on and the main campus at UCLA. And we were always told that we should never go through the park because it was a deep, dark forest in the park and bad things could happen to you in the park. We were instead supposed to make a big detour around several blocks to get to campus. Well, the woods had never been scary to me. The woods had always been warm and open-armed and open-hearted. So I was very glad to be living right by the entrance of that park so that I could literally come out of the place where I was living, walk across the street, open the gate to the park, and walk through this deep woods to my first class of the day, preserving that sense for me of being in the woods. Now, at this point, I wasn't really looking around much. Like most people, I had a kind of general connection to nature rather than anything specific. Yeah, there were the big ones with the bark and the leaves. Those were the trees. And then there were the other smaller plants and the shrubs. And there were little things with wings, and those were the birds. And if I didn't watch where I was going, ooh, I might step on one of the wiggly things, both worms and snakes. And so that was kind of what I was used to, was relating in a really general way to the forest. But as I got more into my adulthood and got to be in places even more of my choosing, I actually, one year, got to choose to live right in the forest. This was such an incredible place. In order to get there, you had to drive on a kind of out-of-the-way paved road and then turn on that road to a road that went up and over the mountain. And from the road that went up and over the mountain, you turned off that road onto a dirt road. And that, as you followed that dirt road along, you had to ford one stream with your car and then continue on a narrower dirt track through the forest and then ford another stream with your car and then at last get to the house where I lived. Now, needless to say, I did not live there in the winter. This was a place that I was able to enjoy for one year only, spring, summer, and fall. But it was deep in the woods, and it was there that I really learned to love and adore the mushrooms. I was just reading an article in one of the science journals that I read that mycology is being turned upside down by DNA analysis of mushrooms, and not just mushrooms, but all variety of fungi and molds and things like that. And I knew that from the time when I started studying mushrooms in the 60s until the time when I was pretty much out of practice in the 90s, that a large amount of the nomenclature had changed for the mushrooms. So I had to smile a bit that the headline on this was saying that mycologists are in the process of changing huge swaths of their nomenclature because of relationships that they are discovering by looking at the DNA. And one of the reasons that this especially made me smile is that there was a big struggle that I had with the mushrooms, which I think would make anybody smile when they hear the struggle that I had. Imagine a button mushroom as you get it in the supermarket. It has a stalk, which is white, and it has a round, incurled cap, which is also white. Now, imagine, if you will, seeing that growing there in the forest, a small cluster of these white button mushrooms, fairly small, not minuscule or microscopic, but not much bigger generally than 3 or 4 inches, and sometimes much smaller. Now, imagine that at some later time we go to the forest and we find a mushroom that is, 5 to 6 inches tall and has a cap like an umbrella or a parasol that is spread wide, and there are edges hanging down from the cap, almost like a solid pieces of fringe going from the stalk out on the undersurface of the cap. I think that most of us wouldn't recognize these two things as the same mushroom. It took me the better part of 2 years being out in the woods 4 to 6 hours a day, laying on my belly, watching things grow, as it were, to make this connection that that little mushroom and this big mushroom are, in fact, one and the same. And this is very much what's happening right now as mycologists are regrouping according to new studies of the DNA. And that is that we are discovering that things that we actually thought were quite different are the exact same thing. Certain kinds of molds that grow on fruit have a sporulating form. And not all clusters of the mold become the sporulating form. And so, again, if you're not living with the stuff, if you're not hanging out and looking at every one of the million apples, you're not going to see it happen. And so you're going to find the sporulating form, and you're going to say, whoa! And you're going to call it by one name, and you're going to see the mold form, and you're going to call it by another name. But in fact, the DNA says, these are the same thing. So, as I said, I had to smile because it made me nostalgic for the times when I couldn't quite figure mushrooms out either. Well, you know, I didn't realize that we were going to spend such a long time talking about mushrooms. Perhaps we should continue our conversation next week.
Sounds good.
All right.
Okay.
Between now and then, everybody, green blessings from me to you, and remember, herbal medicine is people's medicine. It's the medicine that grows right outside your door.
All right. Thank you very much, Susan. And thanks, everyone who listened. This is Green Magic, Green Medicine, with your host, Ms. Susan Weed, an action-packed half hour. And join us again, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, next week. Thank you very much, and have a great evening.